Good evening. For WBAI News in New York, I'm Linda Perry with some of the news for Thursday, December 1st, 2016. World AIDS Day, a day where one honors caregivers and one honors the lives lost and renews the fight against the epidemic. Back in the 1970s and in the early 80s, it was all too common to lose a close friend or a loved one to AIDS. In New York City, more than 100,000 people died of AIDS. The city was the epicenter of the AIDS crisis, but it was also at the forefront of the fight against AIDS, where ACT UP and the gay men's health crisis started, where the earliest trials started, and New York was the first state which created a centralized response to the epidemic. At the peak of the epidemic in New York, there were 15,000 new HIV infections, 10,000 AIDS deaths, 500 babies were born with AIDS each year.
Today in New York, we have dramatically decreased the number of new HIV cases while also achieving a success rate of about 75% when it comes to identifying persons with HIV who are out of care and linking them to care and treatment.
New York State Health Commissioner Dr. Howard Zucker.
Close to 35 years ago, when we were first learning about AIDS, I was first learning about how to be a pediatrician. And I remember this child, it was a two-year-old child, who was sick with what they called an immune problem. We didn't know what it was. And his four-year-old older brother had died. And his mother was always sick, and she couldn't come to the hospital. And we never figured it out. And I think about that family always. And I realized it was probably AIDS. But in 2015 and part of 2016, for the first time since the epidemic began, New York has had no cases of mother-to-child transmission for 18 months. And this is thanks to the extensive efforts and the collaboration among consumers and providers and caregivers and community-based organizations and state and city and local agencies. We are all working on this.
And the goal is to end AIDS in the city by 2020. The new New York City AIDS Memorial Park at St. Vincent's Triangle was dedicated today. It's the first significant public space dedicated to the AIDS epidemic in the city. And according to New York City public advocate Tish James, it's a place New Yorkers will return to again and again if the Trump administration attempts any rollbacks.
Too many gay men and women, and particularly individuals of color, are living every day, and they do not have access to PrEP. We need to ensure that no New Yorker with HIV or AIDS is discriminated against, to ensure that we are continuing to raise awareness and education, because that has been critical in us winning this fight. And may this memorial give us the strength to fight back against this administration that would appoint individuals who believe in junk science like conversion therapy. May this administration hear our cry that we will not go back, that we will not turn back the parade of progress, that we will stand up and fight any attempt to ignore the will of the people in this city. Let this be a message to Donald Trump that love will trump hate, and that we will fight back against this administration. We will join with you when necessary, but if you turn back the clock and if you close our hospitals to health care, we will be here in this memorial organizing and fighting back.
New York City public advocate Tish James at the dedication of the AIDS Memorial in Lower Manhattan today.
I always like to be here on World AIDS Day, and all of us mark the day because it's a day for remembrance, reflection, recharging, and celebration. And now we have a beautiful place to do all of those things in the New York City AIDS Memorial. So I want to thank all those who made the memorial possible.
Dr. Mary Bassett, New York City's health commissioner, works to end health disparities across the city. She paid tribute to some of the activists and advocates who have made the city's services better and accelerated discovery in ending the epidemic.
I became a young doctor when AIDS came to the wards of Harlem Hospital, and it reverberated across the world, affected my work as a doctor in Southern Africa, reverberated through my friendship network, my family. All of us are remembering how many people have stood up and how many people we've left behind. I want to take a moment, though, to tell you some of the numbers that go with those stories, because I am so pleased that as New York City's health commissioner, I can tell you some great numbers that show the impact of the wonderful work that you're doing. You've heard, we have fewer than 2,500 new diagnoses. The actual number is 2,493 here in New York City. That is a historic low. Thank you all, and thanks to our team at the health department. And you heard the number of babies born with HIV. The number is zero. That's the number we want. We like that number, zero. So I want to say a few words about how important disease elimination is to addressing disparities. Because even though we've got these great numbers, we still have a long way to go. 2,500 is too high. And there is a disproportionate burden being borne by the Black and Latino community of this city. That's not fair, that's not necessary, and it needs to change. But when we aim for disease elimination, we eliminate disparities. We make it zero for everyone.
New York City's health commissioner at the dedication of the AIDS Memorial brought some of the many individuals and organizations who have been tirelessly serving their communities for years up on stage with her.
Let me first acknowledge Aisha Diori. Where is she? There she is. For her dedication to improving health and promoting health equity, social justice for the LGBTQ community, youth, communities of color, and for her tireless efforts to create healthy spaces for LGBTQ communities in the house, ballroom, and kiki scene. Thank you, Aisha. Christina Herrera, there she is, for her dedication to combating the spread of HIV and her tremendous commitment to the LGBTQ health, transgender health, and the health of gender nonconforming communities. She is a champion of transgender health. And my colleague, and now moving to activist, I imagine, if he ever, many people move between these, Daniel O'Connell, for his tireless efforts to combat the AIDS epidemic since the beginning, for his unwavering commitment to ending the epidemic by 2020. And Gina Quadrochi, have I got? And you're represented today by her dear friend, Janetta Bushy, who is the assistant director of the Bailey Holt House and a longtime friend of Gina's. Gina is being honored for her dedication to providing stable housing for people living with HIV in order to live fulfilling lives, and also for her tireless commitment to ending the dual crisis of homelessness and AIDS. And the last but not least individual, it's a great pleasure to acknowledge Jeannie Schubert for her dedication to finding stable housing for people living with HIV who often are turned away by other programs, for her commitment to achieving viral load suppression for all people living with HIV, and for the Let's give all four individuals a round of applause. We need to give people personal acknowledgement for the work that they do. And now for the organization, the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender Community Center, for its commitment to creating a safe space and a home for LGBTQ and gender nonconforming communities, and for all the programs that they provide in terms of intervention, social services, and support systems. All of you are going to be the people who stand up to whatever is coming our way, because we in New York City know how to stand up.
New York City's Health Commissioner, Dr. Mary Bassett.
We all need to remember what happened. We never have to live it again.
Dr. Dimitri Daskalakis is Assistant Commissioner for the Bureau of HIV/AIDS Prevention and Control. He says very specific launches are underway.
It was only a glimmer in everyone's eye a year ago that the STD clinics, and I'm not going to tell you what they're going to be called soon, but the STD clinics were going to become machines launching antiretroviral medication for newly diagnosed individuals, PEP for everybody, and PrEP. Guess what? The first two people in New York City diagnosed with HIV in the STD clinic have been started on antiretrovirals there. In the clinic. The men and women who died at St. Vincent's when there were no therapies would stand up proud and say, we are going to treat HIV not as something stigmatized, but we're going to treat it like an infection and take care of it. We are treating HIV how it deserves to be treated, like an infection. Very important. PEP, 28 days of PEP, available at all STD clinics in New York City. Housing Works Undetectables program scaling up across the city. We're teaching the federal government that if you make things status neutral, it may work better. Equal services for people living with HIV and individuals at risk, which is my segue, because that is a portal from the past into the future.
And Dr. D introduced the New York City HIV status neutral prevention and treatment cycle. He says all New Yorkers should get tested for HIV. Some New Yorkers who test negative may still be at risk for infection. And he spoke about PrEP. It's a daily pill which greatly reduces the risk of HIV infection for HIV negative people at risk for exposure. If PrEP would benefit a patient, a healthcare worker would make sure that the patient is medically clear to start PrEP. Dr. D says patients and doctors need to have open and honest discussions about sex and drug use. This to make sure New Yorkers use PrEP and other tools to stay HIV negative. The Assistant Commissioner for the Bureau of HIV/AIDS Prevention and Control spoke at the dedication of the AIDS Memorial downtown Manhattan on this World AIDS Day. In other related news, there's a new report which shows that most Americans live in states where outdated laws can still criminalize HIV-positive status. Andrea Sears reports.
38 states, including New York, have laws that can be used to criminally prosecute people who are HIV positive for potentially exposing another person, regardless of intent, and often when there is little or no chance of transmitting the virus. According to Naomi Goldberg with the Movement Advancement Project, these laws do not reflect the reality of HIV today.
States should reform, repeal, and or modernize any of the laws that criminalize the transmission of HIV. They should take into consideration the best available science and medical evidence and things like intent and proportionality.
Some state laws specifically criminalize behaviors such as spitting that cannot transmit HIV. New York has laws targeting sexually transmitted infections in general that could be used to prosecute people who have had sex after being diagnosed as HIV positive. But Goldberg points out that those with other infections are much less likely to be charged with a crime.
It's only with HIV where people are being prosecuted. Exposure to syphilis or exposure to gonorrhea or to another sexually transmitted infection is very rarely prosecuted, which is problematic.
Goldberg says rather than stemming the spread of HIV, evidence is mounting that criminal prosecutions discourage people from getting tested. And she notes that while HIV criminalization laws are based on the fear and stigma of 30 years ago, advances in antiretroviral therapies and the development of pre-exposure prophylaxis have reduced the threat significantly.
HIV is no longer a death sentence. We have life expectancies for people who are diagnosed and who are on ART that are comparable to individuals without HIV.
A bill introduced in Congress called the Repeal HIV Discrimination Act would encourage states to modernize their laws and update federal laws and policies to be in line with modern science. For New York News Connection, I'm Andrea Sears.
And while New York State is on its way to declaring the end of the AIDS epidemic, that's not true in many parts of the world. Deanne Penn reports.
Last year, 250,000 adolescents were infected with HIV, according to UNICEF data. The agency warned that the number could jump to 400,000 annually over the next 15 years, a staggering 60% increase. UNICEF Executive Director Anthony Lake said that every 2 minutes, another adolescent, most likely a girl, will be infected with the virus. If we want to end AIDS, we need to recapture the urgency this issue deserves and redouble our efforts to reach every child and every adolescent, he stated. The UNICEF report outlined strategies to prevent new infections among young people and to treat those living with HIV. Measures include strengthening data collection and analysis to inform decision-making, as well as prioritizing efforts to address forced sex and sexual exploitation among adolescent girls. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
And continuing at the UN, according to a young activist from India, HIV-positive women face more discrimination than men with HIV. The UN's Daniel Dickinson spoke with Lachwan Zwali at the UN today about the problems facing young people with HIV, especially in accessing vital services. She represents Youth LEAD, an NGO which works with people up to the age of 27 considered to be at high risk of catching the virus.
Women living with HIV, it's really hard more than men, because we have a lot of discrimination more than men. We have a lot of difficulties in accessing the health sectors also, health treatment also. We have a lot of problems there.
Why is there more discrimination?
Because of the gender inequality. Like the woman, as a young woman, when people are noticed we are HIV positive, they ask me that, where do I get HIV? But mostly men, they don't ask that question. And they treat me like that I'm really, really sexual active. That's why I become HIV. That's a question. And they are treat me and judge me like that.
It must be terrible to live with that sort of discrimination and stigma.
Yes, sometimes I try to commit suicide too. And sometimes I feel, when at the first I know my status, I'm really depressed and shocked, because when my husband is know I'm HIV positive, he's kicked me out from the house. And then it's very, very difficult life. And I'm really young and I don't know about the HIV. I didn't get information when I was young, when I was youth. And it's really hard to handle by myself. But luckily, I got the support from my family. That's why I become activist in the youth level.
What did you say to your husband when he forced you out of your home?
When I know my HIV status, I told my husband, I feel like that I got HIV from him, because that I don't know where did they got. And then, but he's reacting me like the, I'm flirting with another people's, and then, yeah. It's really hard to accept our status. So I really understand why he is denying his status. But if I'm not getting married, I won't find out my status, because it below 18 years old, they have to take the parent consent in our country. But imagine that if you are need to test HIV, it's really hard for the young people. It's really hard to take a parent consent, because most of the parents are, they didn't aware about the sex education.
You work with a number of organizations which are helping women like yourself. Do you think you're making enough progress?
In the HIV issues, there's a woman who didn't get a livelihood support and don't have a skills development. Like example, after my husband is left, I'm with my kids. I have to take care of my kids, and I have to earn money for education, for my kids' education, and for ourselves too. But I don't have a skills.
Is this perhaps an area where the United Nations can contribute?
I think so. If they try to find a way, there's a way. If they listen my speech, they will understand what they can do.
Do you think the international community is hearing what you're saying? Do you think they understand your position?
Yes, they will. They will. Because they know more than me, and then I speak it out not from my voice, I speak it out from my heart, and they will understand what I want, and I hope that they will take these opportunities on this, what I'm saying.
And do you see any changes happening? Is the situation improving for women with HIV?
Yes, women and HIV, it's a little bit more improved. But what I mentioned about the livelihood and the skills development, they don't improve.
What's your message to other young women like yourself?
I want to say that before I know my status, I'm uneducated, I have a low self-esteem, I'm a vegetable seller in the roads, and then my husband is kicking me out. I have a lot of difficulties, but I didn't depress. I'm living positively, and I have accept my status, and I take a treatment. I know my status earlier, and I can treat HIV earlier. The young women also, they can become like me. I'm helping another people. I live my life for HIV community. That's why I become more healthier, more than another positive people. They can become like me.
Lachwan's Wally with Youth LEAD. She spoke with Daniel Dickinson at the United Nations. And you are listening to the news on WBAI in New York on this World AIDS Day. In other news, the World Chess Championship just finished up in downtown Manhattan. Organizers estimate that 6 million people around the world followed the quick tie-breaking games. Alex Steinberg reports.
The prize, $1.1 million, divided between two players. The winner gets 60%. The match, which concluded last night, was between the reigning world champion Magnus Carlsen of Norway and his longtime rival and challenger Sergei Karjakin of Russia. And it went on for 3 weeks. In what was one of the most dramatic finales of any World Chess Championship, the champion retained his title. And he did it with what in chess is the equivalent of a grand slam in baseball or a royal flush in poker. His final move was a queen sacrifice that forced checkmate on the next move. Moves like that are extremely rare and come up about as often as a royal flush in poker. It is the first time it happened in a world championship match, let alone in the final and deciding move. 20 years ago, that's the last time New York hosted a World Chess Championship. And much has changed. The sport, like others, has become more commercialized. Although it still lags behind professionals in other competitive sports like tennis or golf in terms of compensation and recognition, there has been a concerted effort for it to become more commercially viable. Besides the prize money, Carlsen has his own line of clothing and has just launched a couple of chess apps that promise to be wildly popular. Behind the scenes, professional chess has always been political. During the Cold War, chess dominance was used as a poster for the superiority of the Soviet way of life. It became a matter of national security when the Brooklyn-born Bobby Fischer challenged the Russian Boris Spassky for the championship in 1972. The Nixon administration considered it a top priority that Fischer take the crown away from Spassky. At one point, when the highly unstable Fischer was threatening to boycott the match, he got a phone call from none other than Nixon's Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger. Kissinger convinced Fischer that it was his patriotic duty to play and defeat Spassky. Fischer went on to become the first non-Soviet world champion of the post-war era. During the present Carlsen-Karjakin match, there were echoes of that Fischer-Spassky match of long ago. Karjakin was helped by the Russian Chess Federation, who saw it as a matter of national pride that a Russian should once more become the world chess champion. And there are allegations that the man who heads the FIDE, the World Chess Federation, who was the former president of the Russian Republic of Kalmykia, is accused of running a dictatorship and murdering dissidents. And there is resentment that Russia dominates FIDE and criticism that it doesn't have the proper entrepreneurial spirit to bring chess into the 21st century. This by those who want to see chess events attract the same commercial sponsorship and big-ticket promotion that has overtaken tennis and golf. What both sides in this debate miss is the possibility that maybe chess can thrive without becoming commercialized. The old state-sponsored system for training and developing chess talent in the Soviet Union is one such model that, despite the corruption that marked that system, points toward an alternative. Despite all of this, the World Chess Championship in New York did not exhibit any of the ugly scenes of nationalism that were so prominent in the Olympics. This may have had to do with the personalities of the players. Both Carlsen and Karjakin were gracious to each other and to the fans, and there was only one minor incident when the champion walked out of a news conference after losing a game. In Norway, Carlsen is a huge celebrity, but Karjakin's performance so endeared him to the public that there is now a Karjakin fan club in Norway. This is in sharp contrast to previous world championship matches where accusations of cheating were commonly traded. And despite the fact that many of the games were dull draws, the event lived up to the expectations of millions around the world with the most beautiful move in chess, a queen sacrifice. Alex Steinberg, WBAI News, New York.
And that's the WBAI Evening News for Thursday, December 1st, 2016. The news was produced with Deanne Penn, Andrea Sears, Daniel Dickinson, Alex Steinberg, and Reggie Johnson. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.